Well, I think we might start if everybody is ready. Didn't there used to be a clock on there? I'm sure there used to be a clock on there. Yeah, there is a circle where it used to be. Oh, well. I make it 1:05, so I think I'll start. Did someone want me to announce about tie night? Well, it was kindly left on the lectern there, tie night. March the 3rd, 5:15, Old Theatre. £4 for members, £5 for non-members. Thai dance, martial arts, instrumental music, Thai food, sounds good. Thai food sounds good anyway, so. Anyone's interested? Please come. Could I just begin this time by apologising to anyone who might have missed the lecture last week. It had to be switched to a Tuesday because I had to go to an all-day meeting. Being now partly a bureaucrat, I had to go to this meeting, and so it had to be switched. But this is the only time, at least this term, which that's happening. I think there are two more lectures I'm due to give this term after this one, and they're both on Wednesdays. I'm also planning, if anyone's still willing to attend, to go on for, 3 weeks or something next term, because a lot of the nub of these lectures, really, the kind of outcome, as I would see it, as in the lectures next term. So hopefully some people keep coming. Just to recapitulate a bit last time and extend the argument. Two views of looking at history, well, at least two views are possible of history, what history is. One is Marx's view, which I've tried to emphasize, in my view anyway, is the Enlightenment view of history. That's the view which Marx shared with Hegel, whatever the difference is between them. For Marx and Hegel, history has form and history goes somewhere. History, if you like, is a linear phenomenon. I think this is very deeply embedded in the intellectual history of the West. It's also there, of course, in evolutionary theory in biology, and Marx was very strongly influenced by evolutionary theory and at one point seemed to compare himself to Darwin. In this kind of view of history, history has not just form but direction. It starts somewhere and in the future it is going somewhere. This is really, really important, I think, for not just for intellectuals but for what the experience of modernity is for most people. Interestingly, if you ask people from Western countries how they see the future, most people see the future as coming out through their left hand, stuck out in front like that, and going back, if they're right-handed, and going back through their right shoulder that way. I won't bore you with why this seems to be true, but history seems to come from behind us and stretch in front of us. When we think of history, I think we do tend to think of something which starts somewhere and has a form. Very clear, I think, for example, in the sorts of histories which say, first of all, you had traditional cultures, then you had civilization rising in the Middle East, then it all sort of grouped around Europe, and then Europe transformed the world. That's history. That was Marx's view of history, and Hegel, in particular, gave it systematic form. But it was not Max Weber's view of history at all. And Max Weber's view, to many people, seems more appropriate to the world in which we now live. That is, a world in which enlightenment, at least in some senses, is being placed in question, and where even time itself might have a different form. For Weber, remember, I just briefly mentioned this last time, history has no form. History is not inherently linear. Whatever linearity there appears to be in history comes from the influence of civilizations, and especially from the way in which civilizations stamp their mark upon their own self-interpretation. Civilizations have a role because of two things, because of the ethical outlook which they promote. A civilization is a way of life, it involves an ethics, there is no society without an ethics, Weber says. This includes market capitalism, crucial thing, be saying in a minute, but it also involves power. It's the conjunction of ethics and power that explains why some civilizations are able for a certain period to become world dominant, and then, as it were, to write their own history. But for Weber, history is literally chaos. And I think this is really interesting. I'd like, if you don't mind, just to try a little kind of excursion on it, because it does resonate with later themes in these lectures. The difference between Marx and Weber was later retraced in a famous debate in French intellectual culture, and in a way it's easier to understand it through that debate. This was a debate between Jean-Paul Sartre, the founder of existentialism, and the celebrated anthropologist Claude Lévi-Strauss. That's L-E-V-I, as in the genes, but not part of the genes family. Unfortunately for him, I suppose, really, in terms of his material wealth. Anyway, Sartre, this was a debate in the late 50s, early 60s, in which Sartre argued from a Marxist position. Sartre argued that history is the progressive conquest of human beings over nature, and the progressive emancipation of human beings from primitive conditions of existence. I mean, Sartre was a very unusual Marxist. He linked Marxism with all sorts of non-Marxist ideas, really. Now, Lévi-Strauss's view of history is much closer to that which Weber had earlier taken, and Lévi-Strauss actually does seem to have been influenced substantially by Max Weber in this. According to Lévi-Strauss, history, what we call history, is actually a product of civilization. History is bound up, Lévi-Strauss says, with the invention of writing. Writing creates history because writing allows you, as it were, to embed yourself in a past. Once you have writing, I mean, a lot of writing tends to arrive with the formulation of dating systems and the invention of calendars. When you have a dating system and a calendar, you have a way of thinking about the past. That way of thinking about the past depends upon records, depends upon documentation, involves the creation of archives, but also, according to Lévi-Strauss, involves the invention of history. And it does something peculiar to time. Lévi-Strauss draws a famous distinction between what he calls cold cultures and hot cultures. These have different views or live in a different way in time. Cold cultures are associated with what Lévi-Strauss calls reversible time, and hot cultures are associated with linear time. Time, as he puts it, which flies like an arrow. Time which flies like an arrow, in other words, which has a direction and lands somewhere. Lévi-Strauss's argument is close to Weber's, because Lévi-Strauss argues that whenever in Western intellectual culture, or indeed to some degree in any civilization, as opposed to a non-writing culture, an oral culture, in any civilization, but particularly in modernity, when we think of history, we actually do think of linear time. For example, what do you do when you learn history at school? What do you understand by history in quotes when you learn it? Well, what you understand is dating, for example. In a certain date this happened, in 1666 that happened, in 1789 that happened. That's what history means. This equates history with change, and it suggests that change can be recorded in a linear way. Now, Lévi-Strauss says this is actually only one way of thinking about time, and it's only one way of experiencing time. It's particularly prevalent in the hottest of all hot cultures, which is modernity. Modernity gives primacy, sort of dominance, to the idea of time which flies like an arrow, linear time, time depending on dating, and therefore thinks of itself as historical. But Lévi-Strauss says this is quite wrong. This is not how one should understand humanity, and it's certainly not how one should understand the relationship between so-called civilizations and other cultures. If you understand that history itself is not linear, That is, there are different ways of experiencing time, recording time, living in time, then this is easier to see, Lévi-Strauss says. And I think this is, broadly speaking, correct. Oral cultures, more traditional cultures, Lévi-Strauss says, tend to live through repetition. In these cultures, for example, traditional ritual, storytelling, the telling of myth, play a central role. You live the past in relation to the future, but the past, in a strong sense, recapitulates the future. These are societies which simply don't organize themselves in time in the same way as civilizations do. And what happens, Lévi-Strauss says, is very much, I think, they use different terminology, but it's very much what Weber is arguing. Civilizations appropriate history, create history, and turn it to their own purposes. But they thereby create a logic of superiority which has no real grounding, which has no logical grounding. So if you go back to Weber, what Weber argues is that West is best, sure, West is best, but only because it's managed, the Western civilization has managed to impose both the view of what, quote, history, unquote, is, and impose itself on other civilizations, especially cold cultures, destroy them essentially, in terms of its march across the world. The dominance of modernity for Weber is a dominance which depends upon a particular mix of culture and power and cannot be legitimated rationally. There's no rational way of saying this is part of an overall movement of history. Now, I'll come back to this in a subsequent lecture because I'd just like at this point to suggest you link it to your own experience of time. Because if it's true that modernity, as it is true, I think, modernity is very much based upon the idea of conquering the future. I mean, the whole point of the Enlightenment, the whole point of modernity was to break with the past and to rationally organize the future. That's why in the West we think of facing the future. Some other cultures think of time as going laterally, by the way, through your shoulders, not, and don't speak of facing the future in the way in which we do. In this kind of society, I think this infects how we think of our everyday lives. It's not just a matter of how intellectuals record history or how states make history or how civilizations generate history. It's also how we live, I think. Very hard for us, in conditions of modernity, to live without projects towards the future. I mean, I would think many people's projects in this room would be twofold: to get a good job, and then you see, as it were, a career stretching ahead of you, and to form a good relationship, whatever it might be, get married, have children, again see something stretching ahead of you for your career cycle. But perhaps this way of thinking about ourselves is something which is becoming compromised. Because if it's true that modernity in some distinct ways is running up against its limits, if it's true, as it seems to be, that modernity and enlightenment were more self-contradictory than their founders acknowledged and than any of us realized, if it's true that the world itself is running up against ecological limits, resource limits, and other sorts of limits of damage, then we might have to learn to think about time differently. We might have to learn again to live in reversible time, and we might have to learn to think of a future which is not the future, or at least not to think of simply facing the future in the straightforward sense in which at least a simple Enlightenment view would suggest. I'll come back to that, because I think this is resonant with the phenomenology of late modernity, if I can put it in a kind of clumsy way. It's resonant with how one tends to feel in our lives. And I think it's relevant, for example, to the analysis of emotional life and personal identity, not just to the macro institutions of our culture. There's some sense in which our psychology is being involved in transformation here, I think. And the reason why, for example, obsessions, compulsions, addictions tend to be so central to the pathology of the emotional life of late modernity is that these are a way of doing repetition. Compulsion, even drug taking, is a sort of way of doing repetition, but a pathological way of living a repetitive past, not geared to tradition, but no longer geared to a sort of open linear view of the future. Actually, Trainspotting has, the novel has a very good exemplification of how it feels to live this kind of life. All this in a way is contained in Max Weber because of Weber's stress that when you understand the rise of the West, that you can't repeat this too often, you are only understanding one civilization among others, and you are only understanding one culture among others. The West has become globally triumphant, at least it's the world dominant civilization, but this is not because its ethical way of life is inherently superior, and it can't be justified as part of a rational scheme of history in the way in which Hegel, Marx, and so many other thinkers wanted. So when we look at the origins of capitalism, Weber says, we mustn't delude ourselves into thinking that these origins can be solely economic. Capitalism seems to be an economic system, and indeed capitalism forces us to live an economic way of life. It forces us to look for jobs. It forces us to think of our lives in terms of the primacy of work. But it is not and cannot be a wholly economic system in itself. It presumes an ethics. There is an ethics, a way of life, a certain, if you like, compulsive way of life in itself, which lies behind the expansion of a modern market economy and which is buried there in its origins. This is the point which I got to in the last lecture. According to Weber, if we want us to understand the origins of Western capitalism, we must see them, these origins, as related to three ethical characteristics of Western civilization, one long-term, two more short-term. So the impact of Christianity in general as a kind of long-term moral ethos of the West, to the impact of Protestantism, or as Weber used to call it, Lutheranism, at a specific conjuncture of Western history, and specifically to the impact of Calvinism and Methodism, these being two versions of Puritanism, again at a certain point in the 17th century, converged with a range of economic factors to produce the takeoff phase of Western capitalism. Christianity is important, Weber thinks, to the overall ethos of the West because it stresses mastery of the world. It is what Weber calls, remember, a salvation religion based on the polarity of sin and redemption. The polarity of sin and redemption gives Christianity enormous generative hold over its adherents, because you're always in pain. You always have something to prove, if you like. Well, I mean, the very symbol of Christianity is a man in pain, is a man on the cross. I mean, you know, you couldn't get more brutal sort of emblem of a religion than that, I think. If you're a Christian, you've always got something to prove, Weber says. But you try to prove it in the world. You try to prove it by showing yourself to be worthy of God. Christianity enjoins the believer to show himself to be worthy of God. And Christianity also creates tension, like Islam, because it distinguishes radically between believers and non-believers. Either you're in it or you're against it, as it were, in these two religious systems. You're either a believer or you're an infidel or you're a heathen, according to both Christianity and Islam. Characteristic of salvation religions, Weber says. So Christianity already contains, well before the 17th century, the period at which Western capitalism becomes formed, Christianity already contains a dynamic element. To that degree, I suppose there's something a bit in common between Marx and Weber, because Marx also saw the West as inherently dynamic. Weber is providing, as it were, more of an explanation of this. And of course, Christianity, Weber's interesting on this, by the way, Christianity has a specific view of time, too. Christianity, many versions of Christianity, anyway, see a promised future. They declare a millennium of some sort. Millennial thinking, again, is a future-oriented, mastery-type thinking, Weber says, very pronounced at certain periods of Christian history. While I'm on this general influence of Christianity in the West, Weber specifically distinguishes the influence of Christianity from Confucianism and Buddhism in India, China, and Japan, Buddhism anyway, and from Hinduism in India. According to Weber, these are what he calls exemplary religions, not salvation religions. And whereas Christianity, oh, sorry, have I gone off, damn it, gone off the whole thing. Oh, sorry about that. I'll put it down here where it should appear. Confucianism, Buddhism, Hinduism, Taoism, Weber also discusses, are all exemplary religions. They're not salvation religions. Christianity is what Weber calls a this-worldly religion. This-worldly religion. Which means what I just said. It's oriented towards showing yourself to be worthy of God in your activities in this world. This is what gets you to heaven, as it were. The exemplary religions mostly tend to be what Weber calls otherworldly religions. These are translations of German terms, but otherworldly religions. If you can compare, for example, Christianity with Hinduism, Weber says, Hinduism sees a world which is a sham. Hinduism declares that reality is a veil, is an illusion. The highest value in Hinduism, according to Weber anyway, is to escape from the toils of this world into a higher reality which lies behind it. The world is illusory. You can progress up a system of reincarnation to achieve the highest religious value. But Weber says, for what it's worth, that Hinduism promotes precisely a system of repetition, not a system of dynamic innovation. Hinduism simply doesn't see the world in these terms. You have to stick to the ritual prerogatives of your caste position in order to achieve movement up the transcendental hierarchy. But Hinduism seeks to escape from the world, not to conquer it, Weber says. It's different from Christianity in this respect. Confucianism, Taoism, Buddhism are also different, because especially Confucianism, which Weber discusses in the book Religion of China, is above all about adapting to the world, Weber says. The highest ethical value of Confucianism is to adapt to a pre-existing world of order. Confucianism sees the world as ordered, stresses duty within the family, stresses fitting in to an already ordered world. It does not have an ethic of world mastery. Now, I'll come back to that a bit later in this lecture, because of course some people have argued that Confucianism does for the East today what Protestantism and Puritanism did for the West 3 centuries ago, provides an ethic which is compatible with the expansion of capitalism. This is not incompatible with what Weber says, for reasons I'll mention later. Weber is talking about the first origins of industrial capitalism, not its subsequent diffusion, which might be ordered by different ethical imperatives, Weber says. So Christianity is a very general ethical backdrop to the way of life of the West, and the way of life of the West is certainly directly linked to the specific period of the rise of modern capitalism. Lutheranism, a specific form of Christianity, Weber says, particularly important because it's associated with the idea of the calling. Luther introduced the idea of the calling, or if you like, the idea of the vocation. which specifically links worth in God's eyes with work. According to Luther, at least in Weber's interpretation of him, we are sent to this earth to work for God in a calling. Success in the calling is relevant to our future as a religious entity in heaven. We are called to do God's duty on this earth and to do so actively. Weber thought the notion of the calling was quite closely related to the emergence of the work ethic in Western civilization. It signals and picks out work as particularly significant. And of course, work in general is related to mastery of the world anyway, Weber's thinking. But to understand the specific conjunction which produced Western capitalism, Weber says, you have to concentrate on this, the impact of Calvinism and Methodism, together with other forms of Puritanism. Weber thought that Calvinism was particularly important in shaping the moral outlook of the early entrepreneurs, whereas Methodism, as I briefly mentioned last week, was particularly important in shaping the attitudes of a workforce to routine industrialized labor, in making this kind of life a conceivable life for an emergent industrial labor force. Let's look at how this happened. Now, what Weber's arguing is that there is no necessity here. The origins of industrial capitalism are not, as Marx thought, bound up with certain necessary antecedents in history. There is no overall historical scheme. Western capitalism emerged as a particular, if you like, accidental conjunction of historical forces. It was not a deliberate creation. It was not part of an overall pattern of history. Everything could have gone differently. If, for example, there hadn't been a reformation, there would not have been the emergence of modern capitalism in the West, according to Weber. Now, look at the impact of Calvinism. Remember, Weber is trying to explain the distinctive moral ethos of the early entrepreneurs, which I described last time. For those who weren't here, that ethos involves a tremendous dynamic imperative to accumulate wealth, but a disinclination to do what aristocrats had always done with wealth, which is to dissipate it on a luxurious lifestyle. The early entrepreneurs, Weber said, displayed this historically unique ethical outlook. We got to make money, man, but we don't want to spend it on our own individual lives. The point of the early entrepreneurs is to live frugally. For Weber, this made possible the capital accumulation and reinvestment, which alone is the condition of a successful, dynamic, capitalistic economy. Now, Weber thought it came about in the following way, and he concentrated more attention on Calvinism than Methodism. Calvinism involves a couple of important doctrines, Weber thought. One is a doctrine of predestination, and the other is a doctrine, if you'll forgive this, of transcendentalism. Calvin believed, Weber says anyway, that only certain people are called to enter heaven. Only certain people are predestined to be saved by God. These people were called the elect. Only a small circle of people are called by God to be saved. And, Calvin added, there ain't anything you can do about it. Either you're one of the elect or you are not. Second doctrine of Calvinism, which Weber focused, is that God is unknowable. Transcendentalism means that God, if you like, is everywhere and nowhere. God cannot be directly known to the believer. This means, Weber says, that the Calvinist believer has lost a lot of the things that believers used to do in earlier forms of Christianity to please God. For example, you could see the priest, and the priest could tell you what you're supposed to do in order to achieve grace in God's eyes. In many religions, including versions of Christianity, there are forms of little ritual you go through to propitiate either the gods or God. Calvinism destroys all this. Calvinism is the most austere religion which has been ever invented, Weber says. It destroys ritual. It destroys the possibility of having a direct ritualized relationship to the deity. God is always there, he's pretty terrible, but you can't really know what he's up to. Moreover, you don't know whether you're one who God is going to call to heaven or not. Now, Weber thought that for Calvin himself, I'm put it this way, it didn't cause too many problems. Because, after all, Calvin invented the doctrine, so he didn't have any trouble about being one of the elect. He just assumed that he was one of the elect. Reasonable enough, I think. But for Calvinists, there is enormous psychological anxiety generated by the doctrine of predestination coupled to transcendence. Transcendentalism, Weber says. Among Calvinists, therefore, and most of the early entrepreneurs, Weber argues, empirically were Calvinists, or certainly one sort of Puritan or another, but strong concentration of Calvinism. Among the early Calvinists, there was a tremendous drive to conquer the world, to work in a calling, the residue of Lutheranism, the residue of Christianity generally, but also to know yourself to be one of the elect. So on the level of lay belief, Weber says, the doctrines of Calvinism became mutated so that success in a calling became taken as a sign of election to God. The lay believers created a subtle but historically enormously powerful change in Calvinist doctrine. To work successfully in a calling became the sign that one was one of the elect. Therefore, Weber says, the Calvinist ethic produced what Weber calls the spirit of capitalism, because the Calvinist believers persisted with all the ethics of Puritanism. They were self-denying, they lived very frugally, they had no interest in personal consumption, but they had this driving ethic of success in a calling. Success came to be taken as material success in a certain occupation, that occupation being in the cities, the occupation of the merchant. Many of the early merchants were Calvinist believers. They became the first capitalists. The first capitalists were Calvinist believers. They both had this driving force to accumulation, at the same time of reinvestment, because they had no moral inclination at all to spend the money on their personal lifestyle. This doesn't mean, Weber says, that Calvinism caused the development of capitalism. It was one causal element among many other more material ones. More material ones included the early emergence of the state in Western Europe, the existence of trading relationships because of the geographical position of Europe. Weber has a very interesting discussion of the city. The city became a political unity in Europe, whereas it didn't in China, and it didn't in the same way in Japan, Weber says, or in India for that matter. A range of material factors were involved in the creation of Western capitalism, but they could not have created Western capitalism without the moral ethics of Calvinism. It was Calvinism which made the causal difference, which generated the emergence of modern capitalism. One causal factor, therefore, among others. Weber specifically argued that he was showing that Marx was wrong in his materialist interpretation of history, because Marx argued that economic conditions created capitalism. Weber's argument is subtly but absolutely profoundly different for the reasons I mentioned. You cannot have an economic system which is not presume an ethics. The ethics of capitalism have become hidden from us, Weber says, by its very success. Calvinism was crucial to the early creation of capitalism, but once capitalism becomes generalized, it no longer depends upon its religious inspiration for its own reproduction. Its ethics become hidden away behind the dynamism of a market society. Weber has a very famous thing on this. He says, the Puritan wanted to work in a calling, we are forced to do so. The Puritan wanted to work in a calling for the greater glory of God. We are forced to do so. We are forced to do so because once it gets going, industrial capitalism is such a powerful system economically, politically, and militarily that it simply generates an inner dynamic of constant change in much the way in which Marx said. Weber agreed with Marx about this. Capitalism is a voraciously expanding system because of its market nature. But the drivenness of the system becomes obscured behind the economic mechanics of the order itself. More about that in a second. Methodism, Weber says, in its way was almost equally important anyway, because capitalism doesn't just need the entrepreneur. It's not just the entrepreneur, the driven, parsimonious entrepreneur. Capitalism needs disciplined wage labor. If you're going to generalize the dominance of markets, if you're going to generalize the dominance of work, if you're going to make people's lives center around work, which they didn't before, in the same sense anyway, something is needed, as it were, to discipline a labor force. That thing was also contingent, was historical, it was other aspects of Puritanism, specifically Methodism, to some extent Pietism, Weber says too. If you consider, Weber argues, and this is surely true, peasant ways of work, first of all, work is not distinct from other kinds of activity. Work is often heavily ritualized. Second, work is sporadic. You work very hard certain periods of the year, and you might not work at all for other periods of the year. Third, you only work to satisfy traditional needs. In a peasant economy or a non-modern society, you only work insofar as you provide for traditionally established needs within the culture. After that, you give up working, got no interest beyond that. Capitalism is not like that. Capitalism is a system which implies that people work a regular working day, that they do so every day, or at least every weekday, and that people have expandable needs. The whole logic of capitalism is premised on this. Now, Weber thought, effectively, what Methodism did was to create a disciplined, ordered labor force for the capitalist to employ. I mean, this sounds much too functional. Weber didn't put it like that. It's, again, contingent. Methodism, however, was a disciplining version of Puritanism which stressed work in a calling, which stressed discipline, which stressed self-abnegation, and therefore fitted, as it were, with the ethics of entrepreneurial capitalism. And what Weber said then, I think, is still true today. Industrial capitalism is still spreading across the world. It's still absorbing peasant cultures, and peasants still feel much the same as they did in Weber's time. If you're an employer and you go to a peasant culture and you try to get people to work regularly for 8 to 10 hours a day, whatever it might be, day in, week in, month in and out, you find it very difficult. People might work 3 days a week and then give up, and not come in for the further 2 days. Why do they need to work anymore? What's the point of it? Well, there is no point of it. As Weber's whole point is, there is no point of it. We simply assume that this is how we shall live, that we will center our lives around work, that this work will be regular, routinized, disciplined, and it is something which we do. These concurrent sets of circumstances therefore created modernity, Weber is arguing. Modern Western capitalism is not, as many people would say, a hedonistic system. Many people argue that Western capitalism, being based upon consumption, is governed by the pursuit of pleasure, that we live in a hedonistic culture if you live the capitalistic way of life. Weber says no. Weber says the opposite, as did Herbert Marcuse and many other thinkers later. Capitalism is based on repression. Capitalism is based upon the subordination of spontaneity, not only in the domain of work, but in other spheres of life too. Capitalism, Weber argues, and this is again very celebrated thing at the conclusion of the Protestant ethic, we are Puritans without knowing ourselves to be Puritans, Weber says. we are secular Puritans in our day-to-day lives when we simply assume the logic of going to university, getting a job, living a life in which work is dominant, retiring at a certain age, having a structured life like that. This is the residue of Puritanism in our lives. Weber thought it had many, many consequences for emotional life as well as for the larger systems of Western civilization. For him, all this sets in train broad processes in the West of what Weber calls rationalization. Rationalization in Western history is the equivalent, if you like, of class conflict in Marx's theory of capitalism. For Marx, class conflict is the dominant structuring motif of Western capitalism and of other kinds of class society too. For Weber, rationalization is the key to understanding what modernity is about. And rationalization for Weber means a number of connected things. The impact of Puritanism coupled with the expansion of capitalism, which eventually becomes a sort of scientific technological civilization, Weber says, that's what modernity is, a scientific technological civilization. Many of the early scientists were also Puritans, Weber says. A very strong association between Puritanism and the rise of natural science, mainly because Puritanism took God out of the world. God is everywhere, thereby nowhere, therefore you can understand the world independently of God. You don't make sacrifices to forces in the world to make things happen. You investigate the world through scientific procedures. So Puritanism underlies the rise of modern science, a scientific way of looking at the world, as well as underlying the rise of capitalism itself. First of all, rationalization involved the disenchantment of the world. Very interesting theme of Weber, I'll just talk about in a second. One aspect of rationalization, its negative aspect, if you like, is the disenchantment of the world. The other side of rationalization, the more positive side of rationalization, involves the growth of, well, I have to put in Weber's terminology, I think. Well, I could put it that way. Means, ends, rationality. I'll explain that in a second. Well, why don't I explain that first? The growth of means, ends, rationality is the growth of what you could call instrumental rationality. It's the idea that you can consciously design things. Before the advent of modernity, the world was largely ordered according to traditional ways of doing things, traditional symbols. With the rise of modernity and the generalization of the Puritan outlook, the world becomes open to conscious design. Conscious organization of our lives, conscious organization of institutions, this is the hallmark of modernity, Weber says. He tried to trace it out, and this might interest some people here, in the domain of law, among other areas. Law becomes transformed with the rise of modern capitalism because it becomes a formalized, calculable system. Weber compares modern systems of justice with what he sometimes calls Qadi justice, Qadi being Middle Eastern ruler. Qadi justice is the sort of traditional way in which justice was dispensed. If you had a case, you'd go and see your local lord or your local ruler, and the ruler would make a judgment. Now, that rationality here was based primarily upon the lord or the king's interpretation of your case. It was personalized, traditionalized law. The king would perhaps make an arbitrary decision, would perhaps consult an oracle, perhaps consult a soothsayer. That's the way in which the decision would be reached. Modern legal systems, Weber argues, are rationally organized. They involve formalized codes. Everything is put into a particular category. Every crime, for example, there are certain sentences appropriate to stealing, which are not appropriate to homicide. Everything is formalized in codes of law. The whole system becomes instrumental, calculable, and formalized. very, very different from traditional legal systems. And Weber didn't think, by the way, that modern law necessarily is always more substantively rational than Cardi justice. Sometimes the lord or monarch might make a more rational decision than you'd make in a more bureaucratic system of law, because everything is a case. That's what you mean in law by a case. Everything is only an example of a category in a modern bureaucratized legal system. Rationalization in this sense extends to all spheres. Weber wrote a really interesting book on music, in which he argues that Western music undergoes a rationalization process from the late 17th century onwards. In other words, you have constructed scales, you have equal intervals between the scales, you have equal timing between a quaver, semi-quaver, etc. The whole system of music becomes rationalized. Most traditional schemes of music do not have this rational form, Weber says. So rationalization is there in the economy. It's there, as I'll have to show next time now, in politics. Very interesting what Weber has to say about politics and socialism. But it's also there in culture. There's a general process of the rationalization of culture in this sense in Western society. The other side of it, what makes it possible, if you like, is the progressive disenchantment of the world. By the disenchantment of the world, Weber meant the retreat of ritual, spirits, gods, demons, religious forces from the world as we understand and perceive the world. The disenchantment of the world means that for most of us, you can't use ritual to get what you want. To get what you want, you must use some kind of interpretation based upon either science or some codified way of understanding the world. For example, you wake up in the morning, say you possess a car, your car won't start. What do? Two ways of looking at that problem. Certain cultures, you might call on God or you might propitiate a spirit. In the West, we tend to believe that if you took the trouble, you could find out how the car engine worked and you could find out what the problem was. Anyone, in principle, can find out anything about any aspect of the world, according to Western belief. Very, very different from traditional enchanted view of the world. In the enchanted view of the world, Weber says, only certain people know. They are normally priests, shamans, sorcerers. You must consult them if you're going to find out and have practical effect on the world. For us, the scientist or the expert replaces the shaman or the sorcerer, but the expert is not like the magician or the sorcerer. The expert knows things which you believe you could get to know if you spent enough time at it and had enough intellectual skill to do it. This is not true of traditional forms of knowledge. Now, lots of interesting things stem from this, which are cultural things, which I'll conclude the lecture on. First of all, Weber says, although we live in a scientific, technological world of this sort, it actually is not as different from the traditional world as you might initially think. Because, of course, none of us can master the totality of expert knowledge. So when you see a weather forecaster on your TV screen tonight saying the isobars have moved closer together and pointing to all these diagrams you know about the weather, obviously in one sense it's completely different from the way in which traditional cultures thought about the weather as influenced by demons, spirits and so forth. In another, it's less different than might appear, because you don't really know, most of us don't really know, what the actual logic behind this is. It's like a kind of magical incantation anyway. So a scientific technological universe, Weber says, does not produce enlightenment in a sense in which one might imagine. Living in it means living in ignorance of most of it, and we simply take for granted that certain things could be known if we took the trouble to do so. Noticing something else very interesting about it, that is the obstinate persistence, especially of personal ritual, but to some degree collective ritual, in a disenchanted world. Weber argues that ritual, sacrifice, propitiation, never completely disappear, because we're all susceptible to circumstances in which either we lose control of the wider world, or we simply are not in a position to apply rational knowledge in a direct way. But this is what we call superstition. Superstition is half-baked, embarrassed acknowledgement of magic. It's the persistence of a disenchanted world which makes you embarrassed because you know the rest of the world is not supposed to be like that. So when you go into an exam and you take your lucky little teddy bear and you put it on your desk, you might be slightly embarrassed by it. Or when you walk along the street and you refuse to walk under a ladder, you might be embarrassed by it. Now Weber argues, I think this is quite right, that ritual forms of superstition, that is the return of magic, are particularly important in situations of manifest risk or uncertainty. He doesn't use this example, but footballers, for instance, mostly have a lot of superstitions. They're in an environment of action which is always open. We never know where the result is really going to go. Fishermen also have a lot of rituals. Miners also have a lot of rituals. And of course, in any tension situation, when you fall ill, you do an exam, any aspect of your life which is tensionful, you might introduce a ritual form of control, a return to magic. Key thing for us, really, is will magic and superstition remain a minor part of a disenchanted world, or are they really staging a return? New Age philosophy, of course, which is a version of disenchantment with modernity itself, stresses that magic and religion are much more fundamental to life than modernity could ever accept. Therefore, you see a return of cosmology. Therefore, you see a return of astrology. Therefore, you see the rise of all sorts of alternative therapies outside of scientific medicine, which don't have the same, quote, scientific, unquote, basis. The question of whether disenchantment, therefore, is ever possible, not really raised by Weber, but has returned to us as a pretty fundamental question at our period of, quote, history, unquote. Well, I hope to see you next Wednesday. Thanks very much.